Hello, everybody. JJ Cooper, Jeff Ponce, Ian Cundall, Baseball America Prospect Podcast. I'll give you a little bit of a sneak behind the curtain. This is the crew this week. We have a lot of people on vacation, but we're holding down the fort. Excited to join you guys for a Prospect Podcast. And once a little different this week, we just thought it was probably a good time to talk about this. Joshua Baez had his remarkable Saturday a couple days ago by now, by the time you're watching and listening to this. But the Cardinals are a team that are kind of in an interesting spot. We kind of wanted to dive into kind of what they've done. How far are they away? We're going to kind of take a look at the St. Louis Cardinals today. And great to see you guys. I think we have to start, and I'm going to start with Jeff, because Jeff has been our Joshua Baez correspondent, I feel like, for years now. But Jeff, okay, I feel comfortable in saying Joshua Baez is not going to do that regularly because no one hits three home run games regularly. But what is a realistic expectation for 27, let's just say, for what could Joshua Baez be and what could trip him up?
Yeah, I think, you know, if he does, you know, win one of the corner outfield spots, whether it's right or left field, going into next season, I think this is a pretty good trial for him. You know, here at the end of the year, he was already on the 40-man roster, so there was just very little risk in terms of calling him up at this point. Has had, it's funny when somebody leads a league in home runs and you say he's had an up and down season. But I think if you sort of look at Josh Baez historically, it took a few years of really being way out there in the wilderness, the type of stuff that when you see this kind of whiff, you see this kind of swing and miss, this lack of production for a player. Usually it's a non-starter. Usually those guys don't have any futures, particularly in Major League Baseball, right? They kind of are or guys and they don't figure it out. There was a substantial change in 2025 in terms of approach. And I think that led to better bat to ball skills. He flattened out a little bit where he had been really, really lofty prior to that. It seemed like they tried to find a little bit more of a happy medium this year of like, hey, you have this huge outlier power, but you're not putting up the home run totals that, you know, your natural power hitting ability should suggest. They tried to add a little bit more loft to the swing, which with any hitter, it comes with a little bit of swing of
miss. It's a trade-off.
Yeah, there's trade-offs. There's like kind of like, you know, it's almost like it's a bad analogy for people, but like a mixing board in a studio. Like there's certain things you can tweak, but you're gonna sacrifice potentially something else. So I think it was a matter of like trying to find that happy medium. He had really, really hot periods during the season where, you know, he would hit 10 home runs. I'm just kind of throwing numbers out here, but like 10 home runs in like 15 games, 16 games. And then he would go pretty cold for stretches as well. And he wasn't walking as much as he had been previously. Some of that, a little bit more aggression as well.
Just to kind of echo what you're saying here. So in April this year, Baez hit 223, 19, 512 with six home runs. In May, he hit 274, 347, 632 with 10. In June, it was 290, 320, 677 with 10. And then in July, it was back to down 208, 303, 506 with six. But then August before the call-up, 308, 372, 538. Now, there's naturally always some kind of up and down in a season, but Joshua Baez has more up and down to his seasons than most.
Sure. And I think some of it is just kind of adjustments with an approach, and it's not using that term more generally, right? Like it's not just, do you swing at strikes? Do you not swing at strikes? It's more the types of swings that he's taking to catch up to high fastballs, which is something that has plagued him at periods in time. And then that will sort of sacrifice his ability to hit breaking balls and soft spot stuff low in the zone. So there's been some trade-offs in terms of the swing. I think what we saw over the last maybe 3 weeks leading up to the call-up was him kind of going back to what he did in 2025 a little bit more. He flattened out a little bit more. He was making a little bit more contact. He was swinging and missing and chasing out of the zone less. And I think ultimately that's maybe the best version of Josh Baez, because you can still have these games where, you know, he sees a soft toss in lefty, which is kind of like
Matthew Boyd.
It's like, you know, there's soft, you know, soft side platoon splits a little bit, which I think could be a bit of a concern, especially when you consider how many right-handed pitchers he's going to see and guys with velocity, guys that can land that high fastball, that high inside fastball. And it's going to be how he makes those adjustments and just kind of finding that happy medium. But he's hit all different pitch types at periods really successfully. It's not like he's been overall terrible against one thing, just like throughout the last 2 years. And so, like, I kind of wonder if there is like just some growing pains with this profile and him, you know, having taken such a massive leap forward, then getting thrust into, you know, the highest level of the minors. And now, you know, we saw what he did in his big league debut. So I think it's just going to be up and down. It's going to be inconsistent. So he's going to put up big power numbers. He's going to drive in runs. Overall, the OPS probably won't be too bad. But, I think projecting next season, you know, the over-under, I think, is probably like a 31% strikeout rate. Like, do you think it will be over that? Do you think it will be under that? I don't think it's going to be like 40% or anything like that. But he's going to strike out quite a bit. Hopefully that comes with more walks than what we saw in AAA for a majority of the season. So it's a tough profile, but he's also super exciting in the sense that it's incredibly high-end quality of contact. He's a good fast straight line runner. He will steal some bases. He's really good in the corner outfield. He's got a big arm and can make, you know, all the throws, throw guys out, and, you know, every base on the diamond. So I think there's some he's going to be really exciting, but he's probably like your number six hitter. And when I started preparing for this show and kind of thinking about like what's a good comp, I think like Teoscar Hernandez is kind of like what the high end outcome is with
like that.
Like, I think he just, it kind of fits fairly well.
So Ian, that kind of brings up a bigger picture question, which is we are in a year, going to have a post at some point about this, updating this pretty soon, but we're in a year of, we know that power's up all across the minors. Like, to just give you an idea, we are sitting here recording this on August 17th, and there are 11 minor league hitters with 30 home runs this year, and there are 27 with 25 home runs or more this year, which, I mean, to just give you an idea, last year there were 18 in the entire season with 25 home runs, and there were five who hit 30. I bring that up because I would say that among our readership, among our viewership and our listenership, those are some of the players that we get asked about the most. We're not getting asked about the guy who's hitting 320 with not a ton of power. Why is this guy not ranking as high as we expect? But it is the Andrew Fishers who have 37 home runs. It's the Blake Burks. It's the Lázaro Montes's. It's the Baez's. It's the, I mean, to take it to another level, it's the Billy Amex and the, and the Miguel Peñas and the Carson Rocafortes and all. How, like, what are you, like, when you have a year where offense and especially home runs are up across the board? I have a theory on this, but I wonder what you think as far as, like, does that, like, help the best power hitters kind of stand out more? Or what do you think, like, how do you kind of compare a year when you have offense up like this, home runs up like this, compared to a year where home runs and offense are really down?
It's an interesting question because I think it does help the top end guys separate themselves and that they can get up into numbers that we usually don't see. Like Andrew Fisher's about to what? He's pushing 40 home runs, which I'm sure you have more historical context on that than I do, but feels like something that doesn't happen very frequently. But I think where actually you see the gains more is with the guys who are kind of outlier seasons where we've never seen this type of power before from them. Because I know like this week I'm working on something, just looking at some under the radar guys. And there are players, there was the number of times I had to write the line, he set a new career high in home runs, was shocking. And it's, you know, you're seeing guys who are, you know, 7, 8, 9 home runs get to 20, 25 that they've never gotten before. And so I think it's more noticeable with kind of the lower end guys. I think with the higher end guys, you know, the power is there. Like, as you said, as Jeff was talking about with Baez, like we've known about his power. You can look at his exit velocities. You can watch his swing. You can look at the way he impacts the baseball when you're watching it on Synergy. And you can tell, I think Blake Burke, Fisher, guys like that fall into that same category. But I think what really separates them and that's why it's kind of more nuanced is when we're talking about things like the top 100 list and everything, is you have to look at the sum of the player's parts, the entire tool, skill set that they have at play. And that's where someone like Baez has those secondary skills that are going to be able to carry him. Because what we've seen at the major league level this year, or not just this year, but over the last few years, is if you're just a one-trick pony who only hits for power and you play a non up the middle position and you don't really bring a lot of secondary skills to the table, teams don't really value that much anymore. You know, the days of a first base slugger who can't play defense and hits 30 home runs, that's a fine player. You know, some teams like that, but most teams don't really want someone like that in their lineup. And so that's why someone like Baez, I think, is such a unique case because of his ability to run, because of his ability to play defense, because he's got a plus arm. And I think that's what separates him and why, like, I know, JJ, you had a good back and forth about someone with Lazaro Montes I saw on social media this week. And he's another one, like, it's outlier power. But the contact questions, and he at least can fake it in the outfield, it looks like, maybe. That which gives them some value. But then you have, you know, you go move down a tier and it's like Blake Burke, Andrew Fisher, like those guys are probably first base only. And when you get shoehorned into that, it really, really backs you in the corner where the power gains and the power ability you've shown this year with, I don't know, maybe a different baseball or whatever other factors are at play that are contributing to the huge home run totals, is that going to carry over from year to year? That's uncertain. So that's why I think that Baez brings that baseline and has that ability that some of these other guys, some of the other big power hitters that you've talked about this year that don't, and why, like, when you're looking at that top level, I think that, you know, you need those secondary skills. When you get lower, though, is where I think we're kind of seeing the biggest gains with this new, you know, run environment that we're playing in.
I kind of do have some kind of evidence of what you're talking about there, and I'll kind of kick this back to Jeff kind of on what your thoughts are. So here is everyone who had 35 or more homers in the minors this decade. Okay, so 2021, MJ Melendez, 41. Griffin Conan, 36. Nick Prado, 36. 2022, Moises Gomez, 39. Alexander Canario, 37. Hunter Goodman, 36. Matt Mervis, 36. Junior 2023, Junior Severino, 35. Shea Whitcomb, 35. 2024, Devison De Los Santos, 40. 2025, Ryan Ward, 36, Spencer Jones, 35. And then, like we said, this year we're going to have that. The thing that stands out about that is that this is kind of why we remain a little bit skeptical on these, is that the one, like, Hunter Goodman is a massive success story out of that group. And kudos to him. But to kind of go what Ian was saying there, that's a catcher. That's a guy who has real value and then has power to go with it. Got a lot of first basemen on that group, like Prado, like Matt Mervis, like Junior Severino, Shea Whitcomb, Devison De Los Santos. Like, there's a lot of guys there who've had very good minor league seasons, and it didn't translate. Jeff, kind of what are your, like, differentiators of when it's going to translate to the big leagues for a guy versus it's not?
Yeah, I mean, I do think a large part of it is the supporting tools and skills. You know, does a guy have defensive value? Is he good at that position? Does he have the ability to fill multiple positions? Obviously, with outfielders, you know, if a guy is an above average corner outfielder with some speed, you could play like a guy like Josh Baez. You could play Josh Baez in center field in a pinch if you really need to. He's played the position before. I think with infielders, you know, if you're not a shortstop, you got to be a guy who's at least very capable at like second or third base, or be able to jump into the outfield when needed. Obviously, catchers, anybody that can catch consistently and like is reasonable as a catch and throw guy back there is certainly valuable. And then I think there's approach, and there's how much contact does the player make, right? Where, like, my concerns with Andrew Fisher really come down to, there are guys who hit a lot of home runs in the minor leagues that hit 200 that under the hood blind taste test look exactly like Andrew Fisher. Like, Jace LaViolette's data doesn't look that different from Andrew Fisher's, right? Fisher barrel rate is much higher, his angle's a little bit better. But, like, as far as contact and all the things that we've seen with Jace LaViolette and some of these other guys, like, that's what we've seen thus far. you know, with Fisher. And so I'm a little more concerned about that. That's like a lower end defensive profile as well. Where, you know, if it was a guy who was putting up those numbers, who was a center fielder or a shortstop, or a shortstop that, you know, had a plus arm and could handle third base without a problem, I'm probably a little bit more into that. Joey Gallo was kind of like that, what I just mentioned, right? A third baseman or an outfielder with a huge arm. There has to be like some sort of, you know, supporting skills and value outside of just what they do as a hitter, because they're going to be so feast or famine. And I think what we see so often is it's not necessarily the bat that keeps hitters or position players away from getting extended run in the major leagues. It's really like, do they have a position? Like, because there's only 30 DH spots, and a lot of teams like to be able to use, you know, maybe some depth they have in the outfield and whatever to rotate guys in there. So it's a really tough position to crack, is to just be a daily DH. I think,
and I would add to that, that when you even do, when you get a chance, right, if you're a first base DH type and you're not a great first baseman, mm-hmm. your window, you better have kind of a Saturday like Joshua Baez had pretty quickly, right, where you do something so remarkable that you then kind of extend that window. Because I think of a guy like Devinson De Los Santos, who, to be honest, has kind of had some of the kind of the path of a Baez, from a standpoint of, oh, he's working on contact, now he's working on getting back to the power, kind of back and forth, but doesn't have the same defensive profile, doesn't have the chance to play in the outfield. And Devinson De Los Santos's opportunities in Miami, which is not a place where it's like, it wasn't with the Cubs and it was like, well, you're, you know, the problem is that Michael Bush is the first baseman, you're just not going to play, or you're a Dodger and it's like Freddie Freeman's there and Shohei Ohtani's the DH. I'm sorry. No, the Marlins had kind of the opportunity, but it was like, you've got this sliver of a window. He didn't show much in that little bit of time. Boom, here you go. You're back in AAA again. That's, I think, the challenge of this for when we talk about these top of the minor league home run chart sluggers. A lot of them kind of fit this profile. Fisher is a perfect example also of, if he ends up being able to play third base, that's a whole lot different profile than if you're purely a first base DH. Still to see on that, but that's kind of the challenge that these guys face. So that's kind of looking at sluggers. But when we come back from this break, we're going to talk about the Cardinals in general and kind of the question of how far away are they? We'll do that right after this quick break.
Hey, for those of you that are on your phones very often, or even if you don't use it much, you should check out your wireless bill and make sure that it is treating you well. It's summertime, you're feeling good, right, AJ? But are you spending too much on your wireless bill, and should Mint Mobile get involved?
As someone that has two college-age kids, Scott, they are always on their phone, whether it's they're checking their Snap, they're checking their DMs, they're checking their Twitter. I need $15 a month because I need unlimited quality coverage that Mint Mobile provides.
To get that new wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/territory. That's mintmobile.com/territory. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/territory. That's it. No catch. Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12-month plan required. $15 per month equivalent. Taxes and fees extra. Initial plan term only. Greater than 50 gigabytes may slow when network is busy. Includes up to 20 gigabyte hotspot. Capable device required. Availability, speed, and coverage varies. See mintmobile.com.
And we're back. And Jeff, kind of when we look at this Cardinals team, they have basically flushed. If you're an old guy, you're gone. The Nolan Arenados, the Paul Goldschmidt's, a couple of years ago, the Adam Wainwright's, like, you know, great players, but that was a team that was getting older and older, and now it is one of the youngest teams in the big leagues. They have played one hitter this year who's 30 years older, Ramon Urias, who's on the IL now. But this is a team that also is kind of seems like it has taken at least some steps. Is 2027 a realistic timetable for playoff contention, division contention, or is this more like a team that's probably still a year or two away?
I mean, if they were in the American League, I think they would actually have a playoff spot right now. They're two games ahead of where the Orioles are right now. They're above 500. They're 63.
Yeah, that would put that. I mean, you'd be You're locked in the AL.
Yeah, I mean, they would be an American League playoff team.
Contending for the AL Central title.
Yeah, and I think, like, when you look at the division that they're in, right, of course, they're going to have to compete with the Brewers, who are good year after year, and they just keep on, you know, kind of turning the crank there. The Cubs have continued to, you know, invest in trying to win now. I don't know if I think the Cubs long-term over the next 2 to 3 years are necessarily better than the Cardinals. The Pirates tried, but they can't really get out of their own way. And that kind of seems like it's same case for the Reds. So I don't think it's unreasonable if a lot of these guys take a step forward that are in the big leagues right now, that are getting valuable experience and have played really, really well. I think it's reasonable for us to expect that JJ Weatherholt could be better next year.
Although he can't get too much better because he's already going to be a 5-WAR player this year.
I think it's still possible, right? Like, he's an excellent player, a future superstar. I think he's kind of cemented that. Should have been an all-star, etc. Alec Burleson has had a great season. I think kind of under the radar, great season. I saw a number today, and I was on Twitter, and I wish I had saved the tweet, but it was looking at all the different, you know, they have the expected home run totals if someone played their home games in certain ballparks or whatever. And if he was outside of Bush, if he was just about anywhere in baseball, he's a 28 to 30 home run bat right now with batting average, some positional versatility, has really locked down that first base job. Of course, we know what Jordan Walker has done. Even if Walker isn't one for one with what he was this season, if it's even 85 to 90%, that's still a middle of the order bat. You know, defensively, they're very strong. Mason Wynn, obviously up the middle with Weatherholt. That's a pretty dynamic duo in your middle infield. And both of those guys are under 25 and will be under 25 again next season. Nathan Church is a good defensive center fielder. They have a couple of really nice bench pieces, which is funny to say. And Brian Torres and Jose Fermin, just guys that on like a winning team can, you know, be bench guys that can fill a variety of positions. You don't want to run with them every day, but can be valuable. I think there's some spots to fill in this lineup, but you look at this team, you look at their pitching. They've gotten some success out of a guy like Michael McGreevy and others. There's others coming up. I don't think they have an ace. We talked about that ahead of time. I don't think there's any like standout, but there's a lot of guys that are like ready-made 4 or 5 type of starters that could be pretty interesting. And they have enough depth in this system to trade for an ace if they really feel that their contention window is there next year or the right buying opportunity presents itself. So I think they've set themselves up fairly well. And if you look at the money that's on the books, they have some money that could be earmarked to go and, you know, sign a free agent pitcher and not really, you know, set your budget on fire or start pushing into areas where, you know, their ownership has not been comfortable spending. So I think Chaim Bloom and this group really deserve some credit. And then you kind of fold in a really strong draft where they had a lot of bonus pool money to spend. And they came away with one of the deepest draft classes of any team in baseball.
I think that you kind of hit on it. Like, one of the things that does stand out here is this: we've got the Cardinals as our number 2 farm system as far as current talent. Obviously, as we always like to say, that's a snapshot, because a guy can go from being the number 1 prospect in baseball one day to graduating the next, or top 10 prospect or whatever, and that will change those calculations. But the Cardinals were a team that sold at the deadline and sold big. Dustin May, obviously the big one being that they traded Dustin May to the Brewers for Alexander Frias and Josiah Ragsdale. But they've made other moves too. They made moves in the offseason as well. The depth of this system is partly because they've brought guys in from in trade after trade after trade. But kind of with that, Ian, like, this is also, I would lay this out, and I ask you this because you watched when Chaim Bloom covered the Red Sox very closely when Chaim Bloom was running the Red Sox. And this is the part that Chaim Bloom has done very well. Did it in Tampa, did it in Boston, is now doing in St. Louis, right? Which is building up this kind of deep and well-rounded core of talent that's kind of either at the big league level or on the cusp. Like, does that, how does this, do you see some similarities here?
100%. I mean, and that was, it was very stark, because that was, you know, what Haim was able to do in Boston was, as you said, the same thing is, you know, he took over a farm system that had been depleted by Dave Dombrowski and a team that just didn't have a ton of talent. And he was excellent at bringing in depth and making trades where he was the one, you know, trading away the major leaguers. And, you know, I think back to like the trade deadline or the trade this year that he made with the Dustin May deal kind of reminded me of one that he made with the Red Sox, was when he traded Christian Vasquez for Willy Abreu and Emmanuel Valdez. At the time, this was a much maligned trade in Boston because Christian Vasquez was like, you know, a clubhouse favorite. The players were not pleased about it, to say the least. And the fans weren't, because, you know, no one had heard of Willy Abreu at the time, realistically, in the Boston area, unless they were reading Baseball America, of course. And they, Willy Abreu now is, you know, one of their franchise cornerstone players. He's one of the best, he's arguably the best defensive right fielder in baseball. He's hit career high 22 home runs this year. He's a chance for a 30 home run season playing right field at Fenway as a left-handed hitter, which is not easy because obviously that's a huge, it's the hardest right field to play in the league. And it's a huge park for left-handed hitters, unless you can pull it right down the line. And so that trade has worked out great. And it's things like that that he was excellent at. He maximized every return. He did very good job drafting. The problem came when it was time to buy. You know, there were some trade deadlines where there was some indecision. It was, you know, how many chips are you willing to put in to push things over the line? Are you willing to go to that next level? Because, you know, as we've seen, and I think Andrew Friedman has the famous quote that if you make a trade that you're comfortable with, you're never getting a trade done at the deadline. And that was an area he struggled with. And I think that's the big question is, has he learned from that? Because that was obviously in Tampa, he had other people that sounding board. It wasn't just him making the decisions. In Boston, he was the ultimate decision maker. And now in St. Louis, he's in that same role again. But I think based on what we've seen so far, I think he's learned from what he did in Boston. Now we'll see. The big question is going to be what's going to happen when they start, you know, next season, when their contention window really opens. Because you look at this team right now, I think their lineup, as Jeff said, I think their lineup's in great shape. They have, you know, it's young, it's talented, it's athletic, there's power, there's, you know, there's different archetypes of player. It's really balanced. And they have reinforcements coming. You have Raniel Rodriguez coming. You know, you have some other players. You have the catchers, obviously, the supreme catching depth they have. You have guys coming that can kind of fill out the spots in their lineup. Maybe third base, you want to say there's maybe some questions there. But I my big question is, what does he do with the pitching? Because I look at that pitching staff and I see some fine back end starters. I'm not sure they have a ton of mid rotation or above starters. And you look in the pipeline, what's coming, you know, Liam Doyle, I think they hope that he could be that. I think that jury's still out on that. You know, I think he's had some good starts. He's had some bad starts, but as a whole, I think it's not just him, frankly. The college pitching class from last year at the top has been kind of a disappointment across the board. Because you kind of hoped like Liam Doyle, and this is obviously excluding Kate Anderson, because Kate Anderson.
Kate Anderson's not disappointed at all. He's been very good.
Certainly not. But I'm talking about Tyler Bremner, Jamie Arnold, and Liam Doyle. And, you know, I think if you're the Cardinals, you would have hoped that he maybe not doing the full Kate Anderson, but if you could get 70% Kate Anderson from Liam Doyle, you know, they'd be in a lot better shape than what they are right now. So is he a number three? Is he a number five? Is he a reliever? Like, I don't really know where he's at. And you look, you know, they have some other interesting arms. I really like Yoiker Fajardo. He's someone with the Red Sox that I've seen. I worry about his fastball quality. You know, is that going to be something that plays above like a number four starter? I'm not sure. Tanner Franklin is huge stuff, and maybe he's their best bet as someone, you know, the odds, there's a pretty good chance he's a reliever, but he might have the highest ceiling of this crew that we've mentioned so far. They have some interesting arms, but they lack those guys that I feel confident, you know, putting a mid rotation or better projection on. And I think that's the question is, how is he going to be able to use the farm depth he's accumulated on the position player side to go out and get those pitchers, or are they going to be able to go out and get them in free agency? And that's something that, you know, he was not able to do in Boston. He was not good at trading from prospect depth to get major leaguers, or he wasn't comfortable doing it, because I think it ultimately, you know, you look at it and you're paying a lot. You're overpaying. Like, you look at the deadline. I mean, look at what they got for Dustin May. I think all of us at the time were kind of shocked that they got as much as they did for Dustin May. And that's at the trade deadline. In the offseason, if you're talking about controllable starters, you're giving up more than that. And that's the question is, you know, will the Cardinals be willing to go into and, you know, trade an Alexander Frias, who they just got, a Trevor Condon, who they just drafted, just to throw some names out, Yairo Padilla. Like, they have the depth to be able to make those trades, but the question is, will you be willing to do that? And I think that's where the jury's still out, because we just haven't seen it from Haim yet. You know, we've seen him build up the system, and I think they're going to continue to build it up over the course of the rest of the season. And I think even in the offseason too, I think that's their best bet is, you know, maybe you trade Ivan Herrera and you get back a major league pitcher as part of the deal. Kind of like what the Nationals just did, where they traded, you know, they traded Curtis Meade and got back Connelly early, like something like that. I wonder if that's the route they go in order to start accumulating the starting pitching depth. But I really think the pitching is the question mark for me, because you look at what that division, who they're competing against, you know, that Brewers pitching staff, you put those two next to each other and it's night and day. And granted, that's partially the Brewers also, but you know, when you're competing against those teams, you need to have that high-end pitching talent. And I just don't know if there's enough in the pipeline yet. And I don't know where they're going to be able to have access to it if they're not going to be willing to spend money.
So that's what I want to get into a little bit more with Jeff. But we're going to take another break. We'll be right back right after this quick break. And we're back. So, Jeff, kind of looking at that, like what Ian just laid out there, I think is kind of an important part of this, which is if I try to spell out starting pitchers who could be ready, are already established for them in the big leagues and are under control for next year, or are the upper minors and could be plausibly capable of contributing next year, I come up with, and cannot say this with most teams, I come up with too many names, right? We've got McGreevy, we got Kyle Leahy, we got Andrew Pallante, Matthew Liberatore, Hunter Dobbins, all are up in the big leagues this year. I would say Liberatore's kind of had the least success this year of that group, but he's kind of had more success in the past. Those are all guys who are relatively established. Then we've got Quinn Matthews. We've got Liam Doyle. We've got Gerangelo Cincha. We've got Tekoa Robey coming off of injury. We've got Yoicker Fajardo we talked about. We've got Tanner Franklin. We're not even done. We could go. And then we've got guys like Odell and all who could be in the pen. Some of these guys could be in the pen as well. But that's more starters. Like, that's enough starters who – that gives you a major league rotation and a triple A rotation. And you might have a guy that you got to hold back in double A, whether he's ready for triple A or not. That's kind of where you say usually that lends itself to making moves. That's kind of the challenge though here, isn't it? Is that you've got to identify who you want to move and who you want to keep. How do you kind of shake that out?
Yeah, no, I think they're, you know, very capable of potentially swinging a trade. Now, I don't think that that's necessarily been Haim Bloom's strong suit, particularly when he was here in Boston. This was something that maybe he didn't have this depth, obviously, at that point where he was still in charge. I think it kind of blossomed and came to the surface maybe 6 months after. But yeah, I mean, I think that that's something they sort of need to take a good hard look at. They have to self-scout well and say, all right, these are, say, the seven names that we believe, you know, are going to be starters for us. Who are the secondary pieces that we could package with another player and potentially upgrade, you know, and find that number one, number two type of starter that I think they need. But they're also in a good position to have a lot of innings available for a lot of these guys that are going to be on the 40-man roster. You know, I think Cincha, though he's been up in AAA, hasn't seen a tremendous amount of success this year. I think that his most recent start where he made the hot sheet, struck out, I think, a career high 11 batters, and just dominated. It was an entirely right-handed start. That was what the Mariners' plan was for Cincha prior to the trade. It was announced maybe a week or two prior to him being traded to St. Louis. And then St. Louis said, well, why don't we just explore this and keep the option open? I think eventually what happens is teams get to know him and are like, all right, this is an undersized, like, dynamic right-handed starter with big stuff, and we should probably just focus on that side. I still think he's going to see a decent amount of time next year in AAA. I don't think he's the first call up, especially when you consider what his Rule 5 year is, et cetera. McGreevy will get some run. Quinn Matthews, I think, will be a long-term option here. it wouldn't shock me if Kyle Leahy or Palante is sort of the older starters that have a little bit more track record, have built up a little bit more innings as well. Both of those guys could be traded, and teams probably would trade something reasonable in return for those two. It's not going to be your trade for a starter, but maybe you get back some decent minor league pieces. We've seen them trade starters and get back some decent minor league pieces, and these guys have cost control and years of control remaining. Maybe that allows them to then trade from some of these hitting prospects at the top of the system that might also have some redundancy. They've had a lot of performances, you know, all throughout this top 30. And I mean, they've been a lot of guys that in other systems would easily rank in a top 30 and probably would be featured in multiple riser posts. And some of those guys are outside of their top 30.
Give me an example. Since you do the Cardinals for us.
Yeah. I think Jack Gerevich, who was on the top 30 in the offseason, you know, fairly not a first rounder, but you know, a third round pick that got a little bit under $1 million out of San Diego last July, who's hit 279, 364, 527. He's up to double A, he struggled a little bit, but is up to double A in his first full professional season. He's got 24 home runs. He's not on the top 30 list. They have another hitter who was sort of a big signing out of South Korea many years ago, was like a social media sensation, Won Bin Cho, left-handed bat, who's 22 years old in double A this year. He's hit across double A and high A. It's kind of an even split over 96 games, 275, 398, 517 with 19 home runs. In double A over 40 games, he has a 19.9% K rate and a 16.1% walk rate. There aren't a lot of 22-year-old hitters in double A with power, with 404 on base percentages that make contact at the numbers he does that would be outside of top 30 lists. I'm not even sure that he's inside their top 35. They may not have like the high end starter. They may not have, outside of Reynel Rodriguez, like a top 25 prospect right now, but they have so many of like the 150 to like 250. It's remarkable. I mean, it's just really high end depth, and they acquired a lot of it at the deadline too.
And that's something we've seen. We talked about this, Ian and I did on the pod or the Hot Sheet Live recently, where we're talking about what the Rays did. And the Rays showed like they were trading these guys who were kind of that 30 to 35 range for them and getting real value back for them, because those guys do have value, Ian.
Yeah, no, that's exactly the point I was going to make, is I think they're primed to do the trade similar to what the Rays did this offseason, or, you know, next year if they get into a contention window over the summer, where, you know, you trade from your guys in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s in your system, because those guys in other systems would be, you know, top 20, top 30 easily. And I look at one point of reference is you look at the return they got from the Diamondbacks. They got Daniel Egan and Sandro Santana. Both those guys were going to be top 20 Diamondbacks when I was planning out the August update for them. And they barely cracked the top 30 in this system. And Jeff knows this. I'm a huge Sandro Santana fan. I think he could be pitching in the big leagues as soon as this season. But in this system, I can't, like, there's no arguing. He doesn't belong. He barely makes the list because, you know, at the end of the day, he's an undersized left-handed reliever with huge stuff, but, you know, that's a limited profile. And in some systems, that's a really,
did
really
get him on 29.
He did. Yes. But in some systems,
awesome since he's been with the Cardinals.
Oh, I watched him. It's nasty stuff. Like, but it's one of those things that, you know, in other systems, that's a guy that, hey, you know, I'm fine. And I look at, like, think of some of the systems I have, like the Red Sox system right now. And obviously that's a bottom 10 system, but they have a reliever in AAA, Angel Bastardo, who was a Rule 5 pick when he was undergoing Tommy John. And he's on the verge of the big leagues, and he's right just outside the top 10 right now. And, you know, a guy like Santana, who probably is like a similar future projection, you're looking at like a 6th, 7th inning arm, is barely in their top 30. And that's, again, I think that goes back to also what Jeff was talking about with the self-scouting. And I think that's one of the most underrated parts of baseball that doesn't probably get discussed enough, is because there's so many different approaches with how teams do it too. But picking, it's not just making the right trades, but it's picking the right players to put in trades. It's, you know, knowing when you're making that big trade for an ace pitcher that, hey, do we want to trade, you know, one stud player, or do we want to trade, you know, 155, or do we want to trade 250s? Or, you know, we have this group of five guys that we have on a similar tier. Which ones do we want to keep? Which ones do we want to trade? So probably one of the hardest things to do because, you know, you're looking at your own system and you have as much information as anyone, but you also have the attachments to them. But you need to be able to separate, you know, these are the guys that we're going to build around. These are the guys that we want to have, you know, we believe are going to be filling these spots in the future. And then, you know, picking, as Jeff said, the redundancies and deciding, hey, these are the ones that we want to flip. And, you know, I think we've seen over the course of many seasons, like some teams are better at than others. You know, I think like I look at the Dodgers. The Dodgers make trades. When they make a trade, if you're the other team, your eyebrows should be immediately raised. Like, why are they offering this player to us? That doesn't make sense. Because over and over again, we've seen them. It's, you know, hey, we're going to trade, you know, someone like Gavin Lux. Okay, why don't you give us Mike Sirota in that deal? Okay, that's interesting. I guess, yeah, that makes sense. Things like that. You know, and then you have the flip side of that is, you know, you look at a trade, I think one that, and it's obviously it's a Red Sox related one, but the Garrett Crochet trade. What happens if they put Marcelo Meyer in that trade instead and offer him up, which I don't think he was, you know, someone that they were willing to trade? Do they keep Kyle Teal and potentially also Braden Montgomery in that trade? Would the Red Sox be better off if it was Marcelo Meyer headlining that trade instead of one of those two guys? I think you could make that case. And so I think that self-scouting is going to be vital for the Cardinals and something, you know, the deeper orgs, especially because there's so much talent to sift through and knowing which of these guys are your future building blocks and which are the ones that you want to use as trade chips is going to be extremely important, especially when you have so many players that are going to have value to other teams.
Two parts with that. I think is a perfect way for us to wrap this up. Which is one is I think one of the challenges of that also is you have to make those trades because we've seen players get stale. If you
diminishing have returns. Players
repeating AAA, their value is going down because, and often their performance is going down as well because people are human. And if you've done it at a level and then you don't get to come up, it's hard to kind of have that same focus to do it again, unless you have a clear flaw to fix. So there's that. But the other part of this that does jump out to me that is also an opportunity for the Cardinals here is the Cardinals, like to start with, what the Cardinals have done this year, I think that is the most important thing, is they've brought J.J. Weatherall up to the big leagues and he's been everything that they expected. Great. Awesome. That's important. Developing Jordan Walker from failed, you know, this was a great prospect and he hasn't worked out to an impact player is, I would say, even more valuable because when J.J. Weatherholt's case, it was don't get in the way. In Jordan Walker's case, it was fix what's broken. So they have this young core now. You throw the Mason Wins in it. You throw the Alec Burleson's in it. You throw, you know, guys like that. But now they got to figure out, okay, which of these catchers fits in our plans and which of them to move on from because they got too many of them. We just talked about it. Like between Jimmy Crooks, Pedro Páez, Leo Bernal, and Raniel Rodriguez, you can't play four of them, even if you say one of them's going to DH or play, you know, move them around a little bit. You're going to have to decide among that group, especially when you throw Yvonne Herrera in there as well. You have that in there as well. But they also have positions like to get better at center field. Could they get better? They need a third baseman long-term, probably. Things like that. And they need an ace. There's opportunities here. But, Jeff, like, okay, if I said to you, among their prospects, to kind of wrap this up, who's the, oh, you just don't trade that guy probably in any deal. Is there a guy or is this more of a organization where it's much more of a tough call on those kind of things?
I think Raniel Rodriguez is definitely one. I don't think you can trade Rodriguez, frankly. At this point, it looks like it could be, regardless of whether he's a catcher long-term or not. And I think there's some hope that you can sort of keep it alive because the arm is huge. The receiving has gotten better. There have been good enough reviews that maybe this could be a 45 glove with a 60 plus arm. And you're probably not going to have like a whole lot of pressure on him to be the everyday catcher because of his ability to play first base, but also, you know, what he's going to carry with the bat. I think it's a similar profile to Yvonne Herrera, but better behind the plate, potentially long-term. And I think a better hitter, more power, more impactful. This could be, you know, your number two, three, four hitter, or however you design your lineup, that kind of a guy. I would say the next name for me after that, two names that I'll throw out there, Leo Bernal. I think he was a little overrated last year defensively. The arm is huge. The framing has always been good. The blocking wasn't great. He really put in some work this offseason in spring training and just throughout the year of improving as a blocker. He controls his bounces much better than he used to, keep stuff in front of him. I think that goes a long way with just some of the stuff that I saw last year and breaking it down. And you're comparing him against other good catching prospects, at least at the time, with Jimmy Crooks, who's since graduated. But I think he's somebody that is young enough. He showed enough impact with a bat. He's a switch hitting catcher. That's somebody to me that, let's wait 2 years. Let's give him a couple years in the big leagues. He might actually be worth more as a trade chip at that point when he establishes himself, especially if Jimmy Crooks is good, or, you know, if Rodriguez proves that he can catch half the games or be a primary catcher, then I think you're in a really advantageous position. The other guy I'll throw out there is, I think, Tanner Franklin. I would, if I was a GM, it would keep me up at night. If that's not to say that if the right deal is there and they can land a huge, and I don't think they're going to be shopping at the top of the market, but let's say things change, whatever, some the economics of baseball change, and all of a sudden they find themselves in a great position to go and acquire some talent that needs to be sold. Maybe you move Tanner Franklin then. Still, that's the kind of guy where giving up on that too early would really worry me, because even if it takes another year or so to get where he needs to be, the flashes that you see are incredible. Like this weekend in Double A, Mikel Garcia, who does not strike out at a high rate from the Royals, is on a rehab assignment with Northwest Arkansas. I think he struck him out on four pitches, blew 100 miles per hour by him at the top of the zone. Now, granted, he gave up a double to some schlub who had no extra base hits the next at bat, but that's like the inconsistencies you have. But you also have to think that he wasn't a starter at Tennessee. He wasn't really a starter at Kennesaw State. So you have to put in perspective, he's kind of learning how to be a starting pitcher right now on the job in the upper levels of the minors. So to me, that's a guy I wouldn't want to trade just simply because of what it can become. I think it's the same with Bernal. And Rodriguez, for me, is just, it looks like a potential superstar hitter. So those are the three I would say are untradeable. That still gives you a lot of ammunition. That is a lot of ammunition in terms of what you could potentially pony up to acquire a big name if you find yourself at the trade deadline next year, way ahead of schedule, with a team that's maybe in first place in the division and looks like a shoo-in for the playoffs. You kind of have the kitty to make a deal.
Well, and I think also the names you left off, they have what teams want, covet. They have upside. You know, you look at some of the names that you didn't say, Alexander Frias, Ty Pete, you know, Jesus Baez, Brandon Clark, Josiah Ragsdale. Like, there's guys with ceiling there. And when you're making those trades, I think it's a lot easier to sell teams on the dream than it is on, hey, we have, you know, this pretty generic college pitcher that, you know, maybe you can do something with or maybe not. Or they have a lot of youth. They have a lot of high ceiling individuals that I think teams will be able to sell themselves on. And hey, you know, if we can get this guy in our org pipeline or, you know, in our development system, we can work with them on their deficiencies. And, you know, when you have those loud tools, those can really catch the eye and can go a long way in helping you make deals. And it's just a testament to their depth that, you know, you listed three guys off there and they're still, you know, you can probably get to 10, 15 guys that are still super interesting that teams would be very, you know, be after as not headline, maybe a trade, but, you know, could be a key piece in a substantial trade.
This is, again, it's a team that we do think is kind of well-positioned, but hey, we thought the Pirates were well-positioned this time last year, and the Pirates, then Connor Griffin got hurt and Paul Skeens took a step back. Like, those things don't happen. The Pirates probably are a playoff team right now. So there is a challenge to this, and that's the steps that we're talking about that they're going to have to make. We hope you enjoyed this edition of the Baseball America Prospect Podcast. If you did, please click the like. That helps other people see it. Do subscribe on the YouTube channel and also to our podcast feed. And obviously check out all the stuff over at baseballamerica.com. For Jeff, for Ian, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.